WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. John Katz has moved the detective novel to the suburbs. His private eye, Kit DeLu, doesn't work on the mean streets. His office is over a shopping mall. The mysteries he deals with are the mysteries of family life. Why kids turn against their parents. Why parents stop loving each other. You may know John Katz from his media criticism for NPR's Morning Edition and Rolling Stone magazine. He recently became media critic for New York magazine. He used to be a network producer for Bill Moyers and the CBS Morning News. When he left his job, he started spending a lot of time in the suburbs, staying home with his two kids while his wife went back to work as a journalist. Katz's first detective novel was called Death by Station Wagon. The new one is The Family Stalker.
The Stalker comes out of the basic premise of the Suburban Detective Mystery series, which is that I find family life and gender changes in suburbia to be very dramatic. The question of families, relationships, and kids. And in The Family Stalker, Kit DeLu, the detective here, is confronted with a literal case of a person who is trying to destroy families, not by murdering them or stabbing or shooting them, but by insinuating herself into these relationships and destroying them from within. It's a person who has reasons for really hating families. And the notion here is that families are very, very fragile and easily off-put, and Kit finds his job here as to protect them.
There's a short reading I'd like you to do that I think gives away a little bit of the character of the suburban detective.
Well, in this section, Marianne Dow, who's an attorney who is also a wife and mother, comes to Kit for some help because she feels the stalkers after her family. And one of the names that comes up in this context is a person named Andrea Luca, who's a friend of hers. So Kit is talking as he is about to investigate this case and has really gotten into it. Kit is talking about his feelings about taking on this case and what it says to families. I believe families, the traditional American foursome, the single parent and kids, the gay couple, or the survivalist commune, are sacred. I believe marriage and family constitute a contract that is horrible to violate, and one that should be abandoned only after every plausible attempt to save it, especially when children are involved. This perspective is shaped by my work, a great deal of which involves sorting through the wreckage of families once launched in optimism and good faith. My code on this subject remains simple-minded in a complex world of nuance and qualifiers. If you have problems, get as much help as you can find as quickly as you can. If you can't work it out, part company as amicably and compassionately as you are able. But to cheat, lie, or sneak around on a partner, I can't stomach that. In my work, I see the victims. My wife, Jane Leon, who is a psychiatric social worker, devotes much of her work to repairing the damage. Given my own non-Republican views on family values, Marianne Dow's story got to me. If Andrea Luca was, in fact, deliberately targeting the Dows for destruction, Marianne was making a plea from which it was hard to walk away. At the same time, I well understand the limitations of my profession. What can a detective do about a family stalker? 30 years ago, the hard-drinking private eye could have scared the hell out of somebody, even roughed up a suspect a bit. But I shopped, cooked, had two kids in the public schools, paid a mortgage and the bank loans on two Volvo station wagons. One well-drafted lawsuit would take care of my ability to pay for most of that. Not to mention what rough stuff would do to the image of a suburban detective. I have to stand next to neighborhood parents at soccer games.
John, what gave you the idea of creating a suburban detective?
Well, I had been working as an executive in television and suddenly found myself at home trying to take up a writing career. And several things were happening to me. I was noticing these incredible changes in suburban life. The suburbs were getting more diverse. There were two lesbian couples in my neighborhood. There were gay couples. And I saw more men around taking care of kids and at the supermarket. I also, as I went through bookstores, which I did a lot, I was struck by the fact that there weren't a lot of books about these sort of normal family life and what I perceive as very dramatic issues in family life. The large question of whether families survive, can they make it, whatever form the family takes, is to me one of the most suspenseful issues in anybody's life. And understandably, we're very preoccupied with violence, as we ought to be, and literal violence, but the damage done to families is really breathtaking. I could see it in the late 80s in terms of the economy. You could see it in terms of alcoholism or abuse. I saw families falling apart all the time. I remember one kid whose parents split up who had to give her pets away, and it was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. So I thought this would be great to write about. I also came to see the suburbs, which are sort of routinely dismissed by a lot of writers as boring, as this laboratory where all these social and gender changes and issues are really played out in the schools and the streets and lives there. So I wanted to try to craft a series that took up this premise that this is suspenseful stuff. This is pretty white knuckle stuff, whether families can make it or not.
We know most private eyes are very urban and loners, even though a lot of the private eyes are getting surrogate families now. But your private eye is really the opposite of this. You know, he's suburban. He has a family that he's very much involved and in love with.
My private eye is strange. He's a real sissy. He doesn't know anything about fighting and is not good at it. He can't stand to be near guns. He is very different from the traditional private eye, who is, and even the modern version, these very good women writers. Their characters are very unattached. You know, they don't have a lot of families. They don't have a lot of baggage. Kit Tulu in the Suburban Detective has got a lot of baggage. He has an old Volvo wagon. He has a dumb Labrador named Percentage. He has two kids. He has a wife who has had to go back to work and get a health plan to support them because he's out of work. And he has to juggle all of his detecting around these issues of investigating plus domestic care, getting his kids to lessons and taking care of their schoolwork. So it's a real juggling match for him. And along the way, he's able to learn about and see these pressures on women and changes in men's lives that I think make suburbia so interesting right now.
Why did you move to a suburb?
The usual reason. I had a small child, and we both wanted her to be sort of free to roam around. I wanted a one dumb dog, and I now have two dumb dogs. I just wanted some more space. But mostly, I think when I had a kid, it's when a time when you start thinking about schools and how you're going to live and a little more relaxed way of living. And I'm glad I did, because it turned out to be much more interesting, you know, than I thought it would be.
My guest is John Katz. His new suburban detective novel is called The Family Stalker. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with detective writer and media critic John Katz. Now, before you became a full-time writer, you used to work in network TV. You were
right.
A producer for Bill Moyers.
Right.
You were the producer of CBS Morning News. Why did you get out of network TV?
Well, in the late 80s, all the networks were taken over, and I left because I was pretty sure I was about to get fired. You know, like a lot of men, I did not make... Very hard for men to make choices voluntarily. Usually they're sort of bludgeoned or battered into doing it. I think I probably would not have left voluntarily if I was not certain I was going to get thrown out in this downsizing.
Now, what did you go through when you left? Did you try to find work at another network? Did you feel certain that you needed to have a job like that to both mentally and economically survive?
No, quite the opposite. I was determined never to work for an institution like that again.
Why?
I really wanted to write. I found the corporate culture was frightening and very difficult. I didn't like what I was doing to people, and I didn't like what people were doing to me. I was determined that I not be detached from my daughter. I really wanted to know about her life, and I think the only way to do that is to be there a lot. You know, I wanted to know who her friends were. I wanted to know what her teachers were like. I wanted to know, you know, what clothes she wore and what went with what. I wanted to know how to treat her when she was sick. I didn't see any way I could do that if I was traipsing into the city every day. And I wanted to take a shot at writing about some of the stuff that I was experiencing and seeing, and because I didn't see a lot of it around.
When you say you didn't like what you were doing to other people and what they were doing to you, what were you doing to other people that you weren't comfortable with?
Well, I think the model of the network executive, like probably the publishing executive or the Wall Street executive, is brutal. It's very confrontational. You sometimes have to fire people, lay people off. There's a lot of politics, which I certainly participated in. To me, it was a violent sort of life. It was frightening. It was draining. It was distracting. I was tense all the time, angry all the time. I just didn't want to live like that. And I thought in particular, I had an opportunity because my daughter was very young to have the kind of relationship with her that very few men have. And also to, I really wanted to try writing, which I thought would give me more control over my life. I mean, I felt like the only jerk I would have to work for was me. And not have to be involved in these sort of institutional politics, which I sort of swore not to return to and have been fortunate enough not to have to return to.
You are a media critic in addition to being a novelist. For years you wrote for Rolling Stone, and now you're a media critic for New York Magazine. I'm wondering, now that you're a media critic, when you look back on the years that you worked in network television, do you see the programs that you did differently now than you did then?
I do. It's a very different perspective when you're sort of caught up in the middle of it and racing around from story to story. You almost can't step back and see it. And now as a critic, of course, I have to look at it differently. I see them as very different. I think one of the things I'm drawn to write about a lot is a sort of explosion of new media, online media in particular, as well as CD-ROMs. I think there's this explosion of new information. People are always running around yelling that there's the death of news, but I think news is being reborn all over the place in ways that are very democratizing.
Let me cite a couple of statistics that I'm quoting from one of your articles on the media. You write that a study commissioned by one network news division in 1992 found that the percentage of viewers between 18 and 34 watching commercial network news dropped more than 45% since 1980. That's amazing. And also that the percentage of people under 35 who said that they read a newspaper yesterday fell from 67% in 1965 to 30% in 1990. Now, the conventional way of looking at those statistics is to be absolutely mortified and say young people must be pretty ignorant of what's happening in the world. They're abandoning news. They're not interested in the world. What's your interpretation of those statistics?
Well, I think this trashing of kids and kid culture is destructive and is wrong. I think, in fact, we're really having to redefine what literacy is and what a news story is, as well as how it's received. I think the traditional models of what we defined as serious news is definitely changing radically. But that doesn't mean that kids are ignorant or that they're not interested. It's just that they receive information in radically different ways. They might receive information from friends, from radio, from computers, from cable, from MTV, from going online. And for example, you know, Prodigy was the place where the news of the earthquake first broke. Kids receive information in fragmented, disjointed ways. They tend not to sit down and absorb whole papers or whole evening newscasts at once. And one reason is I think that kids' agenda is changing, you know, much more than the media is changing. I think we sort of grew up in this Cold War, Washington-driven agenda that isn't connected to young people now. And I think the answer is to rethink the agenda rather than to accuse them of being stupid for not consuming it.
What do you think the media is or should be doing to try to recapture the attention of younger audiences?
Well, there's several things that came up at kids, and I say kids advisedly. I mean, this is really people 40 and under. You know, we're not just talking about teenagers. They, for one thing, they're very busy. You know, they don't really have time to sit for 45 minutes or an hour and digest a traditional media in the traditional way. So I think they're going to be living in fragmented lives. For another, they have many more choices than we ever had. I mean, somebody who sits down with a television and a VCR and a computer has 150 options, where 20 years ago we had three options, you know, a newspaper and the networks, four options. So as long as there are these choices popping on, people are going to be splitting up. Kids like humor. They like organizations that don't take themselves as seriously as traditional media do. They like irony and satire. They like point of view, which the media is very wary of. They like fights. They like people to have the real diversity of point of view. They are less interested in the sort of, you know, Cold War, Moscow, Washington agenda than they are in things that touch them more directly. They're very interested in gender. They're very interested in race. They're very interested in the environment and abortion. Issues like that they see as touching them, they absorb tremendous amounts of information on. Issues that older people are telling them are important, and that are presented in sort of, you know, dull people in suits, they just click off of.
My guest is media critic and detective writer John Katz. His new suburban detective novel is called The Family Stalker. More with Katz in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with detective writer and media critic John Katz. Can I ask you, John Katz,
sure,
if as a media critic you ever feel like you're going backwards? You start by working on TV, the mass media of our time, and then you move to magazine writing, and then to fiction, to novels. I mean, it's not exactly the way to go if you really want to keep up with the new information highway.
Well, I'm very sort of wired into it. I mean, I'm on a bunch of computer bulletin boards, and I follow CD-ROMs, and I write about it.
What do you talk about when you are online? And do you ever use being online as a way to plug your book?
Well, that's a great question. I'm on my base is The Well, which is a sort of San Francisco-based bulletin board. And I'm also sometimes on America Online. There's the men's conference I'm on The Well, which is where I can connect with other men. There's a sort of shorthand. You know, you can't spend too much time. At least I don't have that much time to spend hours online. But when I click on in the morning for half an hour, 45 minutes, we sort of keep up on one another's lives. My particular drama is my daughter is an adolescent now. And that's something I like to talk to people about that I was not prepared for, and had her first date. I talk about that. I found, you know, with men, it's quite interesting. Men talk online much more openly and freely than they do face-to-face. So I've made some terrific friends there. A group of us were helping another writer who has had a lot of money troubles, who was despairing about it. We help each other get published. If one of us gets an assignment and we can't take it, we'll pass it along to the others and see if anybody's interested. And, you know, I'll say my daughter had her first date, and I'll get 10 stories back about how they dealt with it or how they felt about it. If you're feeling, you know, depressed or discouraged or blocked even, you can go online and people, you know, writers will come on, or non-writers for that matter. And I have some good friends in Provincetown on The Well who will you know, who will just tell me to paint pictures of the dunes when I'm feeling, you know, like I'm in a particularly ugly period of New Jersey, this summer especially. So you feel like you can sort of be anywhere.
Your daughter recently went on her first date. Your daughter is becoming a teenager, or
right,
is a teenager. Or
not yet.
Not almost.
Heading
okay.
There.
And, you know, in your new novel, you describe how the father now isn't allowed to sit next to his daughter in movie theaters. And,
right,
you know, they're not supposed to act like they know each other in public. Did you feel betrayed when that started happening to you?
Well, I wouldn't say betrayed. It's a loss. My daughter and I are very close. You know, we've been through a lot together. This whole process of starting to write and what I write about is very connected to my helping to take care of her. And watching her grow up and watching her connected is absolutely the most meaningful thing I've done in my life. It's the most satisfying, it's the most challenging, and the most important work I feel I've done. And not to mention how connected it is to my writing, as you've pointed out. So I am well aware that this is coming. I mean, there's a point in adolescence where if you're close to your kid, they need to go, and they need to not want to be around you. And that of course has come, and it's a loss. But it's very healthy. It's exactly what she should be doing, and it's exactly what she needs to not be made to feel guilty about doing. So I also celebrate it because I think on a very basic level, it means, you know, my wife and I did good work, and that she's comfortable, she trusts us, she comes back when she needs to come back and touches base when she needs to touch base. But I think it's very important that she feel like, you know, she's free to go on her track. And I feel, too, I have a lot of work to do, a lot of writing to do. So it's also time, you know, that we are less engaged with one another. One thing I did that was you know, tremendously helpful, that I think Kit does too in the book, is since she was about 18 months, we started this sort of junk food night, where one night a week, no matter what, she and I will go out and have junk food together. And I started doing this before she could even talk. And it was a great move because it was money in the bank in terms of communicating with her. We, no matter what else is going on in her life, when we sit down and start eating pizza, we talk. And so there's that closeness that I see is there and will certainly transcend adolescence or teenager or whatever comes. And I feel fortunate that I had the opportunity to do that and to be ready, because now that it's happened, without that, you know, I think it would be harder.
Well, John Katz, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
John Katz is the author of the new suburban detective novel, The Family Stalker. He's media critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Morning Edition.